Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, the oil industry would like you to believe that fracking is the miracle cure to all of our energy issues. But energy expert Richard Heinberg doesn't buy the hype and has done extensive research to tell you why. He joins me in just one moment. My second guest today, by the time he was just 10 years old, he'd hitchhiked thousands and thousands of miles around America. He'd lived in vans, buses, even a nice cream truck, and danced around bonfires with some remarkably strange people. Well, you can't have a childhood like that and not write about it. Publishers Weekly gave Joshua Safran's new book a starred review and called it, this is what they said about it, a beautiful, powerful memoir. This assured debut is reminiscent of David Sedaris's and Augustine Burroughs' best work, introspective, hilarious, and heartbreaking. And we'll be bringing that interview to you around 20 past the hour. And ending today's show, if you'd welcome a little romance and suspense in your life, then New York Times bestselling novelist Carla Negers joins me to discuss her work, and in particular her latest work, which takes us to the beautiful landscape of Ireland in Declan's Cross. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Richard Heinberg to the show. He's a senior fellow at Post Carbon Institute and a leading expert on the economic and ecological impacts of fossil fuels. Starting with his book, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, published 10 years ago, Heinberg's written 11 books, all told, about why we need to get off fossil fuels and transition to safer, cleaner renewables. His latest book is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Richard Heinberg, welcome to the show today.
Well, it's very good to be with you. Thanks.
Well, this is a topic that I've wanted to cover for quite a while. But it was just a case of how, because it's not a particularly sexy topic, but it's a very important topic. And I know you agree on that because you've dedicated your career to this subject. How did you become such a passionate advocate for finding alternative fossil fuels?
Well, I've been aware of the environmental crisis for decades now and looking for ways to make a difference. And it wasn't until the 1990s that I finally realized that it was mostly about energy. Whether we're talking about climate change or resource depletion or various forms of environmental pollution, most of that really comes back to fossil fuels, which have been, you know, from an economic standpoint, just an amazing boon to the human race. We've never had anything like them before and probably never will have anything like them again. But the price we're paying is astronomical, and these are depleting non-renewable resources. We can't count on them as being the energy of the future. They're really, at this point, mostly the energy of the past, the 20th century.
Right. On the back of your book, I just want to read this and then have you comment on it. It says the rapid spread of hydraulic fracturing, which we commonly call fracking, has temporarily boosted U.S. natural gas and oil production. But it's sparked this massive environmental backlash in communities across the country. And you know, by the title of your book, Snake Oil, We're Being Sold False Promises. Tell us why you wanted to put this book together.
Well, the energy conversation in the U.S. has changed dramatically just in the past few years. A few years ago, it was mostly about how we needed to get off of fossil fuels. And it was going to be a big job. We knew that. And, of course, the industry was trying to get us to drag our feet. But even George W. Bush said, we're addicted to oil. We're importing two-thirds of the oil that we used. We knew it was depleting non-renewable. It was changing the climate. So just a matter of how and how fast. The fracking boom of the past couple of years has changed that conversation. Now it's a conversation about abundance. The U.S. is going to produce, we're told, the U.S. is going to produce more oil than Saudi Arabia. That the country has 100 years of cheap natural gas. Well, with all of this oil and gas, why should we, you know, why should we have to hurry about getting off of fossil fuels? We have plenty of time to do this at our own pace. Our research at Post Carbon Institute suggests that many of these claims that are being made for the abundance of shale gas and tight oil that we get from fracking, many of these claims are way overstated. This is mostly hype. And the change in the American energy conversation is really to our detriment.
Right. So let's just take a minute to look at what fracking is. And as I understand it, they frack for oil and natural gas.
That's right.
So what's involved in the actual process? Because I was doing some research on it, and obviously I read your book. And the fact that they're pumping up to 600 chemicals in fracking fluid, pumping up to 600 chemicals into the earth, and they can't even name half of them, was really alarming.
Right. Well, some of this technology has been around for a while. Hydraulic fracturing per se has been around for decades. But there's something new going on that's been brought together with the use of a cocktail of chemicals, as you say, up to 600 or 700 different chemicals, as well as horizontal drilling. So drilling down maybe a kilometer and then changing the angle of the drill bit so you're drilling horizontally outward for another kilometer into the oil or gas-bearing layer of rock. All of this has been developed primarily because oil and gas in the U.S. were getting scarce and expensive. And with oil and gas prices very high, that created incentives for small companies that were willing to take on a lot of risk to develop the technology to go after deposits that geologists had known about for a long time but thought were not worth developing. We're talking again about shale tight oil deposits. These are rocks that have oil and gas, but they don't want to give it up. The pore spaces in the rock are very small. It's not it's if you drill a regular conventional vertical well into these rocks, you get a little bit of production, but not enough to justify the effort. So with the new technology of hydrofracturing, fracturing the rocks to release more of the oil and gas and drilling horizontally, it's possible in many instances to produce oil and gas profitably and in a fair quantity. And that has boosted U.S. supplies of oil and gas very dramatically over a short time. But the question is this economically or environmentally sustainable? And we believe not.
Right. And the little bit of research that I did, which is minuscule compared with the extensive research you've done over the years, a couple of the main things that I kept seeing thrown up were concerns about water hazard and concern about earthquakes being caused by the structure of the infrastructure of the land being disrupted. Share with us some actual physical things, if you would, so we can get a picture of the hazards that are involved in this.
Right. Well, with water quality, the biggest hazard comes from disposal of the wastewater from hydrofracturing. Once the 2 or 3 or 4 million gallons of water that are used to frack the well have been pumped down into the well, then they have to be brought back up and put somewhere. So the question is, what do you do with all of that water, which not only has some of these chemicals we talked about, but now maybe radioactive as a result of picking up radioactive nuclides down deep underground? Well, you can send it to a municipal water treatment plant, but water treatment plants aren't prepared to deal with those kinds of pollutants. Or you can put it in a holding pond, but then wildlife are exposed to it, and holding ponds can leak. Or you can pump it deep down underground into an abandoned oil or gas well. But then what you're doing is taking millions of gallons of fresh water from rivers or wells and polluting it, and then taking it out of the hydrological cycle where it can never be used again. Now, in places like Colorado or Texas or California, where there are already problems with access to fresh water, This is a big problem because we're talking about a very substantial amount of water that's used in fracking.
Yeah, I read, and tell me if this is right, that in a typical operation, 2 to 8 million gallons of water may be used to frack a well.
That's right, and that's just one well. And we're talking about many, many thousands of wells that have already been drilled and tens of thousands more that will be drilled before all is said and done. This is not just a case of a few wells here and there. This is a massive operation that's going on in several states around the country.
Right. Also, I read that the average well is up to 8,000 feet deep, so that's causing substantial disruption there, too.
Right. Well, the earthquakes are usually very small, but in places that are already seismically active, like California, there's of course, the possibility that a small man-made earthquake could trigger off a much larger trembler. Oklahoma, for example, is not a seismically active region, but they've had their biggest earthquakes ever recorded that have been associated with either hydrofracking or disposal of wastewater in underground reservoirs.
And so is this going on everywhere in America, Richard? I remember there being huge stories about it going on in upstate New York, and they declared it environmentally unsound, and then it was released, and they said, no, it's okay, we can do it now. And, of course, Pennsylvania has been very hard hit with it. Is it going on everywhere now?
Well, no. There are only about a dozen geological formations in the U.S. where fracking is possible. And the geologists often call these plays. There's the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, the Haynesville in Louisiana, the Barnett in central Texas, Eagle Ford in south Texas, and so forth. And most of these are areas where there's only a small core region, a sweet spot, if you will, where production is prolific and profitable. But you get outside of those small core areas, and initial production rates are much lower, and production declines very rapidly over even the first year. We did an analysis of all of these plays and 65,000 currently producing fracked wells in these plays, and our conclusion was that the production potential has been wildly overstated. Given the rapid decline rates outside of the core regions, what we're actually going to see is a peak in decline in production of both shale gas and tight oil well before the end of this decade.
Wow. And so you have a segment in the book called entitled, Why Do Official Agencies So Often Get It Wrong? So that begs the question, how is it monitored? I read it's not monitored very well, and some of the articles, they didn't believe that it was really being monitored at all. And why do they so often get it wrong?
Well, they often get production potential wrong because the official agencies, and here we're talking about the Energy Information Administration of the U.S. Department of Energy primarily, although also the International Energy Agency, they get future production wrong because what they're typically looking at is future demand, and they assume that the resource will be there to meet the demand. That's a big assumption. And then when we talk about the environmental impacts, we're typically talking about the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. The Los Angeles Times ran a story about a month ago where they revealed that there were EPA field agents, scientists working in the fracking regions who had found clear connections between fracking and water quality and air quality issues. But the higher ups at the EPA had chosen to suppress this research. Now, why they did this, it's you can examine the politics of it and so on. But it's pretty clear that there are some vested interests at very high political levels in fracking. After all, it has been an economic boon to the U.S. Promises. The promises have been made by the companies that this is going to go on for a long time. With more natural gas available and temporarily at low prices, it's possible for the U.S. to lower its greenhouse gas emissions without actually having to institute any federal policies to that effect. So I think the the EPA officials probably, you know, just don't want to look at the environmental problems associated with fracking, and so they just, you know, they shuttered their own scientists' work.
Right. So we've heard stories. In fact, Matt Damon made a film about this at the beginning of the year called The Promised Land, about communities where companies have gone in, oil and gas companies have gone in and offered or promised, you know, made promises of a great deal of money to people who lease off their land to them or sell off their land to them for fracking purposes. And at least in this film, it did not pan out that way. So who really does benefit at the end of the day from hydraulic fracturing?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of the companies that are specializing in fracking, and here we're mostly talking about smaller companies, not the big, you know, Exxons and Chevrons, but companies like Chesapeake, Devon, XTO, Range, Anadarko, companies a lot of people have never heard of. They're, for the most part, they're not making much money on actual production. It just costs too much to employ this really sophisticated technology to produce oil and gas from really what happen to be really low-grade reservoirs. So where they're making money is off of the hype, by hyping future production potential from these massive leased areas, and they've leased millions of acres of land. What they've been able to do is then sell off the leases at a profit, selling them, for example, to big oil companies like Shell, which just announced a $2 billion write-down on the value of its assets, because once its geologists went in and examined some of these areas, these lease areas, they realized that there was no real profit potential there.
Wow.
Or they've sold them to foreign oil and gas companies in China and other nations. So many of the smaller companies are subsisting off of lease sales. Wall Street, of course, makes money at every step along the way, whether it's from sales of shares in these companies or lease sales. Or all of these companies are heavily leveraged. They have to borrow enormous amounts of money. So it's in some ways, this is another bubble, sort of like the real estate bubble or the dot-com bubble of a decade ago.
Right.
And it shows every sign of being ready to burst.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we are doing some damage along the way there, for sure. We know that. We only have about 30 seconds left, Richard. What is your call to action on this? What do you want to leave people with?
Well, you know, there are hundreds of environmental organizations that have sprung up to oppose fracking, and I wanted to supply them with some economic information that would help their case. This is not just an environmental problem; it's also an economic problem. And if folks want to find out more along these lines, they can go to shalebubble.org. Shalebubble.org. That's our website that has the report that we did on our analysis of over 60,000 currently producing wells.
All right. Thank you, Richard Heinberg. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Interesting.
Well, it's a pleasure, Vicky. Thank you.
And Richard's book has a ton of information in here, too. It's called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. RichardHeinberg.com is his website, and you can find out more there, as well as some blog articles up there about this topic, which I think is an important subject. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be switching gears a little. We're going to talk with Joshua Safran about his memoir called Free Spirit. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
It's very, very, very cheap. I don't know about you, but they're putting the hose in. Yes, yes, it's been a hell of a do. They've been putting the hose in. Yes, yes.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Clinical psychologist Guy Winch says emotional wounds can run even deeper than physical wounds. Yet we often try to ignore them, thinking time alone will heal. Well, it won't. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dr. Winch will share ways we can recover from the 7 most common psychological injuries caused by daily life. Find guest details and more than 300 free podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
There's nothing else like it on the dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with Joshua Safran, not to be confused with Joshua Safran, the playwright, because they spell their name the same way. But I sat down with Joshua Safran, who's a nationally recognized champion for the rights of women and a zealous advocate for survivors of domestic violence and the wrongfully imprisoned. He is an attorney, a writer, speaker, and occasional rabbi. And he was featured in the award-winning documentary Crime After Crime, which premiered at the 2011 Sundance Film Festival and had its own television debut as part of the Oprah Winfrey Network Documentary Film Club. And he's written a great book called Free Spirit. It's a memoir of growing up on the road and off the grid. And I'm just going to introduce the segment here by reading just the first couple of lines of the inside of the book cover, the jacket cover. An unforgettable journey through an unconventional childhood. When Joshua Safran was 4 years old, his mother determined to protect him from the threats of nuclear war. And Ronald Reagan took to the open road with her young son, leaving the San Francisco counterculture behind her. And together they embarked on a journey to find a utopia they could call home. And that's what we talked about. Let's bring that on right now. This is the first time you're going to hear this on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Joshua Safran. So Joshua Safran, I want to thank you for joining with us today. And we're going to talk about your new book, which is called Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid. It's a memoir and a very colorful memoir indeed. So I want to start off a little bit with how this book came into focus, because you were actually the subject of a documentary film called Crime After Crime. And interesting story in itself, but yet your story had not been told. So why did you decide to tell your story?
It's a good question. I wouldn't say I decided so much as everyone else decided for me. the movie Crime After Crime follows me as an adult. I'm a lawyer at a big corporate law firm, sort of have a successful practice. And I take on pro bono for free the case of a woman named Deborah Piegler, who's a survivor of domestic violence. And she's also in prison for life, convicted for killing her batterer. And, as part of that case, I end up sort of having a documentary film crew embedded with me for 5.5 years. Invariably, the question arises, why did you, a sort of, white, middle-class Jewish man, take the case of this poor African-American Christian woman from South Central Los Angeles who had been so badly battered and had all these experiences? And invariably my response was, well, because I very strongly identify with her because I had sort of similar experiences as a kid and you know, growing up with a violent alcoholic stepfather, which then led, really, you know, tell us more. And the more I started telling that story, the more it began to resonate with people. And I had a woman who recruited me to perform as part of a traveling spoken word theater piece about what it means to be a man and my experiences as a boy learning what it means to be a man with where the only male role model is a violent alcoholic, etc. So, and then as part of that experience, I started getting these amazing amount of outpouring of support and thanksgiving from people saying, you know, you caused me to rethink my life. I'm getting counseling for my anger problems, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, once the movie hit, there's a short interview with me about my backstory, and everyone said, you know, you got to write this story. And then my wife had for years been telling me I had to write my story, not because of the dark stuff as much as because of the kind of crazy zany part of my childhood, which included, you know, my wife's favorite part was always like, who else lived in an ice cream truck? You have to tell the world about that.
Well, yeah, there are some great stories in here, and I can tell you've got a great sense of humor, and I'm guessing you really needed that to get through this experience. Your mom was described as a big-hearted, idealistic woman, determined to protect you at any cost from the threat of nuclear war and Ronald Reagan. You fled San Francisco and literally spent years living off the grid. So tell us, you know, I read that you lived in shacks, you lived in teepees, the ice cream truck, communes, school bus. What was probably your favorite memory? Because as you just said, I'm sure you had some.
Yeah, I mean, I was given an unprecedented amount of freedom, Vicky. I mean, my mother, you know, for better or for worse, didn't know that you were supposed to treat children any different than adults or knew and made a conscious decision not to do that. So, I mean, can you imagine being a six-year-old boy and being, okay, here's a map. Point at the map. Where do you want to go? Where do we live? What do we do? And being consulted on every decision. And then, of course, I never knew a bedtime. I never knew rules. I could just do what I wanted. So that was, you know, there were times, especially when it was summer and it was warmer months, and we weren't struggling to get through without freezing to death, you know, where I would just sort of wander into the woods and have adventures, and we would meet strange people, and we were hitchhiking, and often that was scary, but often it was really exciting. We'd get picked up by a blue bus full of freaky people identifying themselves as the Roach Coach from Roachberry Farms, and, you know, it'd be like this mobile party for a few days before we moved on to somewhere else. So it was a real sense of excitement and anticipation. You never knew, you know, what's going to happen today, right? And that was a really kind of fun part of things. And then, of course, there was a very, like, chaotic unpredictableness of life, and, of course, always having to be the new kid wherever I was because we were moving, which was hard and less exciting.
Yeah, now sometimes that helps people. It helps them, you know, learn great interpersonal skills, and it helps them become more independent. And other times it can drive them the other way. Did you have to get over that in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the hardest part for me was, you know, my mother's focus was so, she felt that school was no place for children because it taught capitalism and competition and, you know, these negative things. So as long as we were sort of weaving our way through the countercultural people on the fringes of society, all of those interpersonal skills and all of my ability to talk about, you know, Reagan's demonic foreign policy and all this stuff was much appreciated, and I kind of fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But the second that we engaged with straight society and in sixth grade when I demanded to go to school up in the San Juan Islands, you know, when I entered the school sort of having, you know, sleeping every night on the forest floor and having pine needles and sap all over me and my patched thrift store clothing, you know, it was an invitation for, you know, the kids to beat the hell out of me. And that was a much harder transition because all of a sudden they didn't care if I was, hello, I'm charismatic and can tell you, you know, stories about, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which
sure,
I've experienced,
sure.
Which of course was like, that's inappropriate, and you can't talk, you know, and I really didn't have any filter. I wasn't socialized to know sort of what, quote-unquote, straight society would find acceptable and wouldn't. And that was a very difficult transition.
Yeah, well, I think anybody who's not been living in mainstream, whether they're, you know, like filming abroad for several in the jungle for several years and then they come back, it's a huge shock. And how much time did you spend up here in the Northwest?
So most of my time between, you know, let's say, 83 and 93, so about 10 years of my childhood was in Washington State almost entirely. And like Skagit County, Snohomish County, Island County, and various other counties in there. But those were the main three areas where we kind of wandered around.
Right.
And my mother just sort of randomly, we were living in sort of a off-the-grid survivalist community in Idaho, and my mother somehow found out that Skagit County, Washington was going to vote or had voted to become a nuclear-free zone. And so in her mind, that meant, oh, there must be a conscious community of good folks out there, and we it took us a while to find them. And in 1989, we did sort of find the last commune, which my mother considered sort of the promised land, and we stumbled into this commune in very rural Skagit County.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that is, I think, thematic throughout this is your struggle against your fear of not being able to defend yourself or your mom when this, and I'm going to read this, sporadically employed ex-Salvadorian revolutionary and guerrilla poet became her husband. That sounds like something straight out of a movie.
Well, he was, in retrospect, you know, I actually have a newfound sort of humor and appreciation for this guy. But, yeah, you know, my mother was, she always had this fantasy that she was going to sort of meet and marry Che Guevara. I mean, that was sort of her motto, was sort of this Latin American shaggy revolutionary who just was kind of a man of the people and was willing to sacrifice all for the good of, you know, the innocent third world or something. And she met a guy who kind of fit that description vaguely, and, you know, who was proud to tell us of all of the people that he had killed, but they were, you know, he was killing the right people, meaning, you know, the bad death squad American backed people in El Salvador. And he passed himself off, just as you say, as a shaman, rebel, poet, healer, all these things. But of course, he was also a violent alcoholic, which became his defining characteristic in my eyes. And my mother, part of her, you know, sort of, as you say, sort of big-hearted idealism, was she very much believed that your politics define you. So if you were a violent alcoholic, but you had a certain set of political values, you should overlook the violent alcoholism. And on the flip side, which became very fascinating for me when we moved to this place called Stanwood, Washington, in Snohomish County, you know, if you were sort of like a Republican, white Christian guy, it didn't really matter what your values were or how you treated people, because your sort of broad definition of who you were meant that you were on the wrong side of things. And so it was fascinating for me once I began school in sixth grade and began to ultimately have some friends and kind of meeting these people and realizing, oh, they voted for Reagan and they have jobs and they're, you know, part of mainstream society and they seem like really good people. And like, I know that they can't be because they, you know, voted Republican or whatever, but they seem good. And then over time, of course, I realized, like, hey, yeah, shouldn't we be judging people by the content of their character, not, you know, their superficial political view.
Right. And so then at some point as a child, Joshua, you recognize that, hey, education is my way out of this. It's my way out of the abuse. And, you know, it's my way of taking the opportunity of creating a life that I choose myself.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the arc of free spirit is that realization and sort of my mother's position that school was no place for children, you know, became sort of, no, that my conviction is this is where I have to be if I ever want to survive. And I was really fortunate to have an on and off again mentor, this guy who I called Uncle Tony, who is this Mexican-American countercultural philosopher / janitor who we knew from the commune days in San Francisco. But he had sort of had a similar path in his life. He had been kidnapped as a child and horribly abused. But he kind of took a vow that when he met me when I was born into the commune, that he was going to try to look out for me and make sure the same didn't happen to me. And it was always his conviction that if he only could have stayed in school, that he would have gotten out of this life. And so he always kind of taught me, you know, this is what you have to do. You just, no matter how hard it is, you have to stay in school. And that's, I put my faith in that, that no matter how hard it was and whether I was struggling or whether I could do my homework by the light of a flickering candle in a rainstorm, whatever, you know, I had to try because that was just an article of faith. And thankfully, you know, it paid off.
Yeah, and there's a very telling statement at the end of the book when your mother sees the film, the documentary film Crime After Crime that we mentioned in the beginning. And she says to you, I never knew that the abuse affected you that much. And you replied, of course it did. And she said, but it was only for a few years. And I think that's so telling of an abuse victim.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in her mind, she was like, well, I was, you know, in her mind, she's like, I was 40 at the time, and then I was like 44, and life went on, and, you know, whatever. And for me, of course, that same period of time is like from like 9 to 13 is like a very different period of one's life. But also, there's, you know, fundamentally, my mother, for whatever reason, is just one of these people who would just kind of fall down, and sometimes literally, you know, and then immediately get up and wander forward with a smile again. She just had this, and it's sort of forgetting everything that had come before, which is, I think, was a defense mechanism, in part because she dealt with, you know, family violence herself as a kid. So it was just sort of, that's how she, her brain worked. Whereas for me, you know, I dwelled on this period for years. It took me like a decade to sort of stop wanting to and preparing to kill my stepfather, and sort of being able to let it go and say, okay, you know, life moves on, and I can now, you know, be, can let that go.
Right. So you said at the end of the book that writing the book was a response to your mom, or you called her Claudia because she thought mother was too limiting. I laughed at that, Joshua, because when I was about six, my dad said, don't call us mom and dad anymore. Call us June and Brian. And it lasted about 3 days because then everybody said I was adopted. So I insisted, no, I'm calling you mom and dad. But so you wrote this book as a response to your mom. You said it reopened imperfectly healed wounds and healed them properly. What is it you would like people to take away from your story?
Well, you know, I think one of the big things is that, you know, people are, should be free to pursue their passions. But when you have a kid, life must change. And I feel that even, you know, in my generation and forward, there isn't enough appreciation of that. And I think people sort of feel like, well, you know, 40 is the new zero, and I should just be able to do what I want to make me happy. And it's like, nope, when you're a kid, when you have a kid, you have to recalibrate yourself, and you may have to make sacrifices, and you have to do things that are responsible and boring or whatever. And you know, so that's sort of one meta lesson for me. But the other is, I think that I did actually gain a lot of important and unconventional education from my mother. I mean, she always was very good about, you know, you can do anything you want, Josh. You can be anything you want. You know, so that aspect of it, I think, is something positive to take, to sort of instill your kids
right,
confidence
right.
And humility. I mean, that was, my mother was always very, you know, anybody who wanted to talk to us about anything, my mother would listen to them until they were done talking, even if it was like literally a naked crazy man who popped out of the wall of forest on the trail in front of us. My mother was there to listen, and she was like, we're not better than that guy or anybody else, you know. And so that was another important lesson that I think I did learn from her.
Well, awesome. Joshua Safran, I thank you so much for being with us today. The book is called Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid. And I'm pleased to say you are now happily married with a very stable family life and children of your own.
I am. And some of that is my rebellion to the way I grew up. And also, you know, you're naturally drawn to what you don't have.
And that was Joshua Safran. His book again, Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid. On the Road and Off the Grid. Why can't I say that? All right. So He's done some amazing work, so check out his website at jsaffron.com, jsaffron.com. There's more about the film there too, as well as his book. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back in just one quick tick with Carla Neggers. And she is a New York Times bestselling author, and we're going to take a little journey with her. This is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, October 13th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. We'll catch up on all the animal news that's happened, and we'll have open phone lines for your calls and questions. So if you've got a problem with any of your animal friends, call me and I'll help you fix it. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Clinical psychologist Guy Winch says emotional wounds can run even deeper than physical wounds. Yet we often try to ignore them, thinking time alone will heal. Well, it won't. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dr. Winch will share ways we can recover from the 7 most common psychological injuries caused by daily life. Find guest details and more than 300 free podcasts at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Don't forget, this is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, you are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and I'm very pleased to have with me now New York Times bestselling author of many novels of romantic suspense and contemporary romance, including Heron's Cove, Saint's Gate, That Night on Thistle Lane, and Secrets of the Lost Summer, Carla Neggers. And her new book is called Declan's Cross, and I'm going to bring her on right now, and we can hear more from Carla. Carla Neggers, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
And you just got back from Ireland, and let's jump into that because this book is based in Ireland. And I know it's somewhere you like to go frequently from a couple of pieces that I read about you. One of the things you said was, I just enjoy being there, but I also enjoy researching the history, art, geography, wildflower, wildlife, food, and whiskey.
That covers it all, doesn't it?
And maybe it all looks better with a whiskey. I don't know.
Oh, that's fun. Well, there's actually a whiskey connection to the Sharp and Donovan series, which Declan's Cross is the third book in the series. You can dive in at any point in the series, but we have this Irish priest, Finian Bracken, and he's a whiskey expert with kind of a mysterious past. So it's been fun doing the whiskey research, I've got to tell you. I've been learning more and more, you know, but I have that after I hike the Irish Hills.
Yeah, I don't think you'd be doing much hiking if you had it before.
Oh, all things in moderation. But we love to hike. I would guess that would be one of our very favorite things about Ireland, is just walking the ground. And it was, you know, it was walking the ground that helped inspire the idea behind Declan's Cross when we were there. It was last May. We go several times a year. It's just like a pop fly from Boston. We live in Vermont, and our kids are in Boston, so we just boop over to Ireland. Right? Makes it sound so easy, doesn't it? But it really makes a difference when it's not such a interminable flight. But in any case, we were walking on the South Irish coast in Ardmore, which is a very beautiful village on Ardmore Bay in the Celtic Sea, and it's got these beautiful, beautiful sea cliffs, and you can do this cliff walk around the cliffs and ruins, and it's in the St. Declan country. And so, you know, going through the ruins and seeing the cliffs and, you know, having a nice lunch at a cute little restaurant in town, got the idea for for Declan's Cross percolating. So I created my own little village on the South Irish coast in this Ardmore area, and we have a 10-year-old art theft, two FBI agents on vacation, and a missing American diver, and this village with sea cliffs and ancient ruins, you know, a sheep farm and a boutique hotel and all kinds of little stories. So that's kind of what inspired me, was just taking this walk on the south coast of Ireland.
Wow. So I was actually going to ask you that, and you answered it for me, if the story became, you know, if the story drove you to Ireland or if the story developed while you were there.
You know, and it wasn't conscious in the sense that, I knew that Emma Sharp and Colin Donovan, who are the continuing characters in the series, they're two FBI agents, and Emma is a art crimes expert with an Irish connection. Her grandfather is a world-renowned art detective who's based in Dublin, but he got his start on the south coast of Maine, where she grew up. And then Colin Donovan is an FBI agent who's a deep cover agent, and he grew up just a few miles from Emma on the south coast of Maine in this little struggling fishing village. So they're very different and yet have certain things in common. The FBI, Maine, but her part of Maine and his part of Maine are very different. They met over the murder of a nun in Saint's Gate. And so they've had, and he's coming off of this very intense undercover assignment, tracking down international arms traffickers. And so they're actually supposed to be taking a break in Ireland. So when I was coming up with the idea, I knew they were in Ireland, giving a little bit away at the end of the Heron's Cove, but nonetheless, I knew they were there, and I knew something would happen. But beyond that, I was on vacation.
And so tell us how that comes together then. So when you get back home and you've got this, fairly well-visualized story in your head, how do you start putting this together?
You know, I just dive in. I'm one of those writers who dives in and just start. I start writing. I have a sense of things, but when I say a sense of things, it's this sort of this. It's almost like a little kernel of something that's going to turn into this big tree, you know, or the spark that lights the fire. It's just bits and pieces, and then I get writing, and. And then I stop and I come up for air and I figure out some stuff. So I write and plot at the same time. But I will start out with a sense of story. But it's more like say I write a page and a half of a synopsis. Then I send it to my editor and my agent. We talk about the story and say, you know, am I off the deep end here? Have I got something? And, just get some feedback. But I usually have a pretty good sense of where I'm going. Mm-hmm. And just that starting off point, that spark, and then that's what I feel. So I'm not one of those detailed outliners.
Right.
Some days I wish I were, but you know that's what we have. These long walks. I live in Vermont, so I can take off into the Vermont hills. I go to Ireland. I do writing there. As I said, I just got back, and I did quite a lot of writing while I was there.
What a place to do it. You know, I remember going to the Lake District in England. I actually have never been to Ireland, but I'm going to change that soon. But I remember going to the Lake District, and there's similar country there somewhat in some regions, you know, based on what people have told me who've been to both places. And I remember not wanting to leave it. I just wanted to get a little cabin and write and write and write.
There's something about that, isn't there, where you just removed from everything. And plus, it's Ireland is 5 hours ahead of where I am in Vermont. So, you know, I can be at the bar with my little whiskey or my glass of wine before anybody figures out where I am and can find me. Life is good.
Oh, that's too funny. And it's such a, I mean, they're such great characters. I know that because I used to work with many, many, many Irish people, and they have such a great sense of humor. So,
the ready Irish wit. I have a great friend in Ireland, John, and he's helped me with so much research, and he'll track down any kind of expert. He must know everyone in Ireland. So when I was researching Declan's Cross, I mean, he's a whiskey expert, so that we're starting right out there. That's
there you
helpful.
Go. Right.
Yeah, and he forgives me any of my whiskey mistakes, you know. So, but he and I've learned so much from him. He's incredibly generous with his expertise. But when I was writing Declan's Cross, I had questions about sheep farming, and he had grown up on a farm, but he went and tracked down his farmer friends, and I mean, I learned more than I wanted to know about liver fluke, you know.
Well, you have to tell us what that is now, because I don't know what that is.
It's a parasite that attacks the sheep.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really nasty. The research included pictures, you know. It's like, Okay, we don't need to describe that in the book.
So, right.
But sometimes it's in a story, it could be what happens, what I call happening between the commas. You know, it's just these little tidbits, these little snippets of information or an image or a detail that, for me, helps the story, the setting, the characters come to life.
Right.
And so those are the kinds of things that I'm trying to get at. And then there's just some, you know, in doing some of the Irish characters, there's some of the word difference. Like, do you say faucet or tap? You know, little things like that. And sometimes you can forget to ask, and like, it's the one word you don't ask about that you might mess up on. But I think it did a pretty good job with it. It was fun. It was so much fun setting a story mostly in Ireland. Declan's Cross is the first. I mean, I've set books partially in Ireland, but Declan's Cross is really mostly in Ireland. There's a part of it that takes place in Maine too, with Colin Donovan has these three brothers, and they're back in Maine, supposed to not be helping him, but of course they are. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But most of the story does take place in Ireland. So I created, we have Kitty, our boutique hotel owner, who has this on-again, off-again relationship with an Irish detective who's a friend of our Irish priest, a whiskey expert, who's serving a church back in Maine in Colin's hometown. It's this whole big universe that all comes together. It's so much fun for me. You know, I'm writing Harbor Island now, the next book in this series, and it's just like, you know, I just sit there, get my coffee, come down, and I'm back in this world, and I just love it. I have such a good time.
Playtime.
Yeah. Well, things happen, but you know.
Yes, and you do get that suspense in there, which is good, because you know, that makes it more of a page turner, if you will. So, but you are known for developing great scenes that are really, really vivid, and we should let listeners know. You've written at least 60 books, right?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
I have. I've been at this for a while.
Yeah, and I read you started writing when you were 11 years old, and you climbed up a tree with a pencil.
I did. That's the absolute truth. I obviously, it was during the good weather. I grew up in a little town, Western Massachusetts, and I would, it's our family homestead, a tree farm. We still have it, and I would climb up in this big maple tree and sit on my favorite branch, and I mean, I knew exactly where to sit so that I could have both hands free, which is kind of mind-boggling right now. If I went out and saw my kid up in a tree, I said, "Ma, you never paid attention," you know. But she says, "Oh, I knew you were fine." Anyway, I was up in my tree writing away, and I'd read books up there too, but I love to write. I have 6 brothers and sisters, and it's 7 of us within 9 years. So it was a great way to just get away from everything and everybody, even though we all got along, we all had a great time, but sometimes you just need that time. And I love to tell stories, so I'd sit up there and I would write my stories. And but you know, that's writing, we're all told, is impractical as a career choice, so you try to have something practical on the side, and my choice was music.
Right. Isn't that practical? Oh, well, that's not practical either. let me tell you that one. I was married to a musician.
it was bad. And because I mean, I could play French horn, and I was all right on piano, but boy, when it came to the real serious stuff, I mean, it was not what we call my vein of gold.
Right. Well, Carla, you know, we are almost right at the end of our segment, and we have to rush out of here, but I want you back when your next book comes out, okay? We want to talk more about whiskey in Ireland and the good, fun stuff you're having writing these books.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I love talking with you. CarlaNeggers.com is where you can find out more about Carla, CarlaNeggers.com. And the book is called Declan's Cross, a Sharp and Donovan novel. Please join us next week. We'll be right back. I'm going to get booted out of here. Got to go. Bye. Live well. Live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.